We're dealing with magic. And the way that I'm dealing with it is traditional, so that you don't get the magazine version. You don't get the kind of brief, flashy version. But we are talking about magic. We're talking about the essence of magic. Yet the core of magic is a powerful language which controls. Why does the language of magic control, and what does it control? It controls everything that is. It controls, in essence, nature. How does it do so? Because the language of magic can rearrange it. It can rearrange it in terms of arrangement. It can rearrange it in terms of structure. It can transform it. So the rearranging is like a surface phenomenon of what also can be done structurally by, I guess the word that you might be familiar with is transmutation. Rearrangement is a precursor of transmutation. The transformation is the process, the transmutation is the changed structure. So that, for instance, the alchemical goal of transmuting lead into gold. This language, this magical language, is extremely powerful, then, in its ability, first of all, on the surface to rearrange. But in magic, one does not have to physically pick up the objects. The images of the objects are sufficient. If you rearrange the images of the objects, you have rearranged nature. So that the esoteric use of imagination, in a magical sense, not in a natural sense, but in a supernatural sense, is to change the arrangement. And by changing the arrangement in the imagination, the arrangement is changed. Now, one can step back and say, is this so, and be skeptical about this. And there are many ins and outs to it, but you should know that this is exactly true. It's difficult in our age to believe this or to understand this, but it is true. And perhaps the easiest way is for you to think to yourself that nature really isn't pigeonholed. The objects in nature do not have pigeonholes. Their order is intimately tied up with the order that we perceive in our mind. And if we change that order in our mind, that arrangement, that order is changed. Now, of course, if you just do it off the cuff, if you do it according to a private arrangement that you yourself have come up with, that arrangement tends to be fantasy and doesn't really do too much. But if one receives a training and tradition, this can be done. And it moves from fantasy to a kind of a phantom-like ability, capacity. This arranging of images is the surface phenomenon, and the deeper aspect is the transformation of structure. And that is not an exercise in imagination, but an exercise in memory. So that memory deals with structure. Imagination deals with what we have talked about, an image base. All magic is circumscribed by these two activities, imagination and memory, in these ways, their coordination. And the key to it is that in the image base, in the imagination, what moves are the images. But in memory, what doesn't move is what works, the structure. Now, where the imagination and memory come together, like an hourglass, if you want to imagine something, where they come together, that point is the self. But it's a point that has no dimension. It's a Euclidean point, where all dimensions. The most powerful of all surviving magical expressions in the 20th century is, not alchemy. Nuclear physics has superseded alchemy by yards and miles. But the tarot deck. And the tarot cards, a deck of tarot cards, is legitimate high magic, indeed. But the tarot deck that we have, that comes down to us, is a pastiche. The weight deck that you see in parlor magic is just that. It's parlor magic. But the real tarot deck, the real use of the real tarot deck, is indeed very high magic. It is also associated with great art, high classical art. And in fact, the most comprehensive of all the classical real tarot decks was done by a very great artist named Mantegna. And it was done about 1465. And Andreas Mantegna, if you are not familiar with his great art, one of the great artists of the Renaissance, a little bit before Botticelli. Mantegna was married to the daughter of Giovanni Bellini. Now, Mantegna's tarot deck is very rare. And in 1981, 500 copies of this were printed in Italy. And when Mr. Hall and I saw that this was available, we quickly ordered half a dozen of them and got them into the PRS, put one into the society, and I have one here. It was limited for 500 copies. When one looks at the tarot, the I Tarocchi del Mantegna, you do not find the tarot deck that you have in parlor magic. You have the real high magic tarot deck that the Renaissance, the High Renaissance, 1465, put together from the late antiquity, late 3rd century, early 4th century AD, which was the last time that it was on the surface. The last classical remnant of the original book of pictures, of images, were the so-called hieroglyphics of Hierapolo. That is, someone who is a high priest of the Hermetic tradition whose name was Horus Apollo, Egyptian Greek, Horus Apollo. And the hieroglyphics of Hierapolo date from the 4th century AD. They date from Egypt, and they are just like the Nag Hammadi manuscripts. They're remnants of a great tradition, the backbone of civilization, that was driven into exile, driven into fleeing by the militant codification, recodification of the Roman Empire using Christianity as a restructuring of its empire. And consequently, we can't go into this here to too much depth, but in the 4th century AD is the decimation of the classical tradition and the rise of the new Rome. A Rome not based so much on military might, but the might of the church. Not the church that you would recognize today. There have been many, many changes. But in the 4th century AD, it was the church militant, the church triumphant, the church become a Roman Empire, refurbished and completely outlined. And the document which is the seal of that triumph is Augustine's City of God. And you can see in there a complete reinstatement that the Rome of pagan days is now displaced by the City of God, and Rome becomes the eternal city. Now, the classical Hermetic tradition was driven underground, driven into exile. It wasn't like a prescription that this year, if you're caught, you will be killed. It's that it went on for centuries. The Tarot Deck of Mantegna from 1465 in Italy, northern Italy, is a painstaking, accurate reconstruction and re-presentation of the classical high magic book. So that the cards that one has, and there are 50 cards in the Mantegna deck, 50 cards, and they're pictures just like you would imagine a tarot deck to have. These 50 cards are arranged in 5 sets of 10, so that the basic structure of the Mantegna tarot deck, 5 sets of 10. So somehow 5 is very important, and within 5, a sequence of 10 in each. Now the 5 sets of 10 that are here in the Mantegna deck are the classical 5 parts of the ancient theory of memory, which came down as the 5 categories of rhetoric. And I've been explaining to you why classical rhetoric had everything to do with the teaching of memory, with the training of memory, which meant also the organizing of the imagination, which meant the development of a sense of the deep self. The 5 classical parts of memory, and I'm reading here from Francis Yates's The Art of Memory, but you can find it in many other places. For instance, the little Latin treatise Ad Herennium that I had out here last week is her source, but I'll give it to you from her listing because it's a little bit more convenient, seeing as I've left my copy of Ad Herennium back in the back room. The 5 parts of rhetoric, first one is inventio, invention, inventio. The second is dispositio, disposition, or as you would probably understand it, distribution. The third is elocutio, that's elocution. The fourth is memoria. And the fifth is pronuntiatio, pronunciation. Now, as it comes down here in the list that Francis Yates gives us, which is characteristic of the rhetorical textbooks which have survived, there's almost no indication that this is arcane. that this is powerful, that this is indeed the essence of high magic. And that's why Ad Herennium survived. That's why, for instance, another version of it, somewhat conflated, survives in another Roman rhetorical textbook, the Institutes of Quintilian. And one can find correlations in Aristotle's book, Rhetoric. These survived because they were not recognized to be esoteric. They were thought, in fact, just to be schoolboy textbooks of the art of public speaking. And if you're going to establish a new Rome, you have to have young men, and so young men were trained in this. They were trained by these textbooks, by these techniques. What happens, though, is that as you are trained with these techniques, the inner self wakes up. But because you are oriented to a kind of a worldly empire organization, you do not live out the inner awakenedness which comes naturally with this kind of training, but you transpose it constantly. And over the centuries and over the millennium, the schizophrenic mind of Western man has developed from just this flaw. If you speak directly to the inner being of a person in the West, they are extremely conscious. But if you speak to their worldly self, they're usually very stupid about spiritual things. They will even be stupid to themselves, not listen to themselves. And this generates all kinds of crashes, psychological crashes, and anxiety, and so forth. So it has become characteristic of Western man since the 4th century AD. Before then, it was not characteristic. The 5 sets of 10 in the Mantegna tarot deck are also arranged in an ascending order from 1 to 50. And the first one comes down in the tarot deck that you find in living rooms and so-called New Age workshops that are held at nice little hotels near airports and things like that, as if you're going to find anything arcane in such environments. Well, the first one is what became the Fool card, but is misero, misery, il misero, man in his scrambled condition. And you can look at these later. And the 50th card is the cosmos. So that the progression in images is to rearrange misery, the Fool, into the cosmos. But the rearrangement, the transforming of this I'm used to calling him the idiot rather than the Fool. The transformation of the Fool into the cosmos is the linear progression in terms of image rearrangement. But that cannot be done until there is a structural transformation. And of course, the structural transformation, classically, world round for all time, has a 5-phase cycle. It has it in the Upanishads in India, it has it in the Tao Te Ching in China, it has it in the Hermetic tradition from Egypt running all the way through the Hellenistic world, the Renaissance, and up to the present day. So when someone speaks to you glibly of transformation, oh, you've got to have transformation, ask them, what phase are you speaking of? You can sort the wheat from the chaff with one question. In other words, you have to know where you are. You have to know where there is to go. you have to have some idea of how to go there. It's not very difficult. It just takes an awful lot of dedication to actually do it. But if you don't know, you will never find out by guessing. No one ever found out by guessing. Because there, in each phase of the transformation cycle, everything that was understood is now different. And it's like the previous ordination is now scrambled. It isn't that way anymore. The poles have changed, the coordination is all in a different dimension. So there's no way to guess. There's no way to make a lucky guess at all. Everything is different all along the way. And it just takes time, that's all. It takes basically dedication. Now the five different sets of 10, I don't have time to go into today for you, but I brought one set of 10, which I'll lay out on the table, and during the break you can see. This set of 10 are the nine muses and Apollo. The nine muses and Apollo. Some of you, but not very many of you, have been with me long enough to remember that Apollo is not a figure like other figures. Apollo is a symbol and not a mythic image. For instance, there are in classical Greece, that is to say Homeric Greece, there were three recognizable ways, the three tires of the chariot of the Sri Vesvatara Upanishad. There are three basic ways in which a human being goes outside themselves. You go outside yourself in terror, and the Greek mythic image for that was Ares, or as the Romans called him, Mars. Terror. You can be terrorized out of yourself. And if you haven't, believe me, you can be. You can go outside of yourself in ecstasy. Ecstasis, the very word. And Aphrodite was the Greek mythological image for that. Venus to the Romans. Not just convenient passion, but passion. And the third way is through transcendent wisdom experience. And Athena was the Greek mythological image for that. Those three ways of going outside yourself, terror and ecstasy, which balance each other, which are polarities, and transcendent wisdom, those three, when they focus together, that is what Apollo is. He's not a mythological figure. He's a symbolic focus of this range of going outside of oneself. So that Apollo is indeed a major godlike figure. He is symbolic of that godlike focus of all the ways in which you are able to go outside of yourself. To not know this is to misunderstand a fundamental quality of reality in terms of the Greek psyche. To not know that Apollo is also the very essence of all of the shamanistic possibilities, to use a contemporary term, that Apollo is the obverse of Dionysius. And Dionysius is the obverse of Apollo. To not know that, to think that there are polarities, will literally drive you mad. And although that was not the root cause, it was a contributing cause to Nietzsche's madness. Nietzsche's great penetrating book on the origins of tragedy made the Apollonian, the Dionysian polarities. And they're not reverses of one another at all. There's a different relationship. They're obverses. Two sides of the same coin. They are the same coin. They're not different at all. Is this so? What was the most powerful of all of Apollo's shrines? Delphi. And what went on in Delphi? Oracular vision. Sitting a 12-year-old psychic on a tripod over a vent that went down who knows how far in the earth, and she gave the oracular of, this is shamanism with a capital S. That's where Apollo's shrine was. Anyway, Apollo belongs with the set of the nine muses. You remember the phrase, I'm sure you've heard it, memory is the mother of the muses. These nine feminine images are the nine images of the arts of human expression. Their mother is memory. The grandmother of all human expression is memory. She is indeed venerable, but she is not pictured because she is not picturable. So Apollo stands in her place. Why can Apollo do this? Because he is indeed real on the level at which the mother of the muses is quite real. And so Apollo is put in here, and the nine muses are given to us. In each of the muses, Mantegna has a wonderful presentation where you have a kind of a open blank circle hidden in most of the cards of the muses, and you can take a look. There are some esoteric formations of them, but you'll find there are the nine muses and Apollo. So they form one of the five sets of ten in the original High Renaissance tarot deck from the 15th century by Mantegna. And you can see the other five sets here. And I'll leave the cards out for you, and I'll put the Fool and the Cosmos together. Now, the reason that I start this lecture off in this way, first of all, is to let you know that there is really wisdom to be had and to be learned, and to be satisfied with pastiche surrogates is very low level indeed. But it takes a little bit of dedication, it takes a little bit of tenacity. Now, the art of memory, the art of memory, has everything to do not only with the transmutation of the structure of whatever is going to be real, but also the old Delphic maxim, know thyself. It has everything to do with remembering who you are. So it has everything to do with the deep self. Who must remember? Who must know themselves? You. What is the you in that designation? Your person. Your person must remember its deep self. And just in a coordinated way, as your person remembers its deep self, your person becomes quite real. But the emergence of the person is a transformation process. It has that all five stages that work into it. And while one is born naturally, one is reborn through high magic of initiation into this five-phase cycle. And in the fifth phase, the quintessence of it is that the person becomes real. Death does not touch such a person. such a person does not vanish. Death is nothing whatsoever to such a person. Francis Yates, in The Art of Memory, gives us the famous Greek story of how the art of memory was first discovered. She gives us the tale of Simonides, and most of you were here last week. Can you remember that little tale? Is there anyone that doesn't remember it? Do I have to tell that tale again? Seated at a banquet, and Simonides thanks Castor and Pollux along with the host, and the host is offended because he wanted all the thanks for himself, and thereby in an indirect way curses the gods by not allowing the gods their due, and Simonides is called away from the banquet to go to the door, and there's no one there at the door, and while he's at the door, the roof caves in and kills everyone, and they're so mashed no one can identify the bodies, and it's only because Simonides remembers where they were seated that they were able to be buried in the proper way by the proper families, and he meditates on that and comes to understand that the arrangement of images by place when sealed is very powerful. Not only do you remember the images, but you bring into play a structure for remembering that was in the mind in the first place. But that it's not so much in the mind, but was in the deep self. The arrangement is in the mind, but the structuring is in the deep self. That spiritual self of a person contains a structuring process which is eternal, and the mind on the surface is able to rearrange and bring itself in sync with the deep self. So that literally, when the person is ready to be born, they step forth from their mind in the arrangement of the mind, which is the cosmic understanding. But the deep self has never been other than what it is. And its structuring capacity is what has allowed for that cosmic mind to come into its final arrangement, into its true arrangement. And the progressive development of this, we're like the five primordial geometric forms which you can find in Plato's dialogues. And Plato got it from the Egyptians, who got it from lost antiquity. Of this kind of geometry, Pythagoras said, this is history. Historia. History is the progression of these primordial forms characterizing the primordial stages by which the deep self manifests itself yet again as the real person of the cosmos. Now that's basic tradition, whether it's in the West or the East. It doesn't make any difference. You can find it quite accurately both places. She gives the story of Simonides. And in the Greek version of the story, there is an emphasis upon sight. And indeed, in the West, the emphasis has always been on the element of sight, so that we have, for instance, the symbolic metaphor of inner sight, third eye. But one could just as well, if you're truly cosmopolitan and ambidextrous, you could speak of a third ear, of an inner ear. There's no problem whatsoever. It's just in the West there's a bias for the eye. In the Indian tradition, though the eye is favored also after the Hellenistic intrusions, the ancient tradition was for the ear. That is to say, in ancient India, before the Greek intrusion into it was for the ear and not for the eye at all. So, for instance, like in Vedic or Upanishadic lore, it's what you hear. And it isn't the third eye, but it's the sacred word that one hears, Om. The way that the art of memory was discovered in Indian tradition is the following story told of the great sage Valmiki. Valmiki is not a personal name. It's an ascriptive name. Valmiki means white anthill. It means someone who is so adept at yoga can sit so long in one place that the white ants will build a hill around them. It's a way of saying this is somebody who is really knows how to do it. And sitting in deep, deep samadhi one day, and in the forest, as one should have in those days, and a bird was singing, and suddenly the bird song stopped. And instantaneously, Valmiki came out of his deep, powerful samadhi, saw that the bird had stopped singing because it had been shot by an arrow, and saw the hunter who had shot the arrow, and all in the same spontaneous instance cursed the hunter, and the hunter just shriveled into a black wisp. Little soot stains went through the forest. And then he went back into his samadhi, and then began to concentrate on why. Not why did he smite the hunter. Are we there already?
No. I don't know what to do first.
This is a democratic age. In ancient times, I would have thrown the goddamn things out. Valmiki, thinking in deep concentration, not just in concentration, but you have to understand powered concentration. How powered? All of it, like a nuclear dynamo. And in that power of concentration, when one engenders that kind of intensity, one goes beyond white hot to clear. One is able to resolve any image on any level in any exactness required. Any exactness that is required, you can resolve it. But he was resolving not in terms of sight, but in terms of sound. And so Valmiki's high-powered dynamic samadhi resolved the fact that the curse had a sine wave pattern. And in holding it in his mind's ear, he saw that this pattern was an eternal pattern. This arrangement of sounds was an eternal arrangement. It was like somebody who takes the sine graph from an oscillograph and holds it up and sees that this is true of all sound. The wave may be stretched or it may be crimped a little bit, but the essential form, the symbolic exactness of the form, is just right. It always will be that way. All sound has this capacity, but the human voice is the focus of this capacity. And the human voice, powered by deep meditative energy, is the archetype of this sine wave. And that the language form which expresses this deep-powered sound archetype was the double line, the couplet, in Sanskrit poetics called the sloka. So that Valmiki began then to tell himself the story of the hunter, to use the killed, the vanished hunter. And as he told himself this story in sloka form, spun it out, he began to realize that there was an enormous epic pattern. And that epic that he told himself is the Ramayana. so that Valmiki's Ramayana is the ripples through the whole language capacity of ancient India of this deep self-perception of the archetypal symbol of what sound is in its eternal thusness. Now you can see how enormously amplified the power becomes. In the Ramayana, one of the great epics of India, structures the feeling tones of Indian civilization. The other epic, the Mahabharata, structures the thinking tones of Indian civilization. For instance, in the Mahabharata, in the sixth parva, you have the Bhagavad Gita. The Mahabharata is all about the thinking, the conscious balance of it. The Ramayana is all about the distribution of bhakti through the whole civilization and the whole texture of the civilization. The whole feel of India is in the Ramayana, is in Valmiki, in his deep understanding that the ear and the inner ear has an archetypal fulcrum upon which all expression is founded. It's the complement to in the West of the God's eye, being able to see as God sees. Where in ancient India it would be being able to hear with the Brahman ear, the ear of Brahman. For memory to work, one must have had that experience. One must have had at least an introduction to that quality of experience. That the whole art of memory, the whole practice of the structuring of magic, the whole use of conscious expressions, conscious languages, conscious language of color, like in painting, conscious language of sound, like in music, conscious language of words, like in poetry, conscious language of forms and spaces, like in sculpture. The primordial structure for training the memory was to arrange the images in some kind of an order based on a deep self insight. But the most primordial of all the structures which was used for the mnemonic process to be activated was architecture. And the art of architecture is the art of sacred building. I'll use an example from antiquity, which everyone, because of our cultural archetype, will understand. Let's choose a sacred building, which is at once a work of architecture, which is at once the key to the art of memory. Solomon's Temple. The specificities of the proportions, the dimensions, the characteristics of Solomon's Temple are spelled out to the nth degree. And in fact, in terms of actual history, in order to build his temple, Solomon contracted the best builders, the most accurate builders of the day, who were Phoenicians, the company of Hiram and Company. Why were they the best builders of the day? Because they built boats. A shipwright is the most accurate of all builders. If you don't build a boat just right, it won't float, especially in the storms that come up, and you want to know ahead of time. You want to know more than United Airlines wants to know that its jets are not going to fall apart. You want to know, is that boat going to hold together? So a shipwright in ancient antiquity was the nth degree of the correct builder. He knew exactly how to do it. So when Solomon's Temple was built by Hiram and Company, who came from the Phoenician coast, who had access to the timbers of Lebanon, shall we wait again for